Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
For up-to-the-moment Rhode Island news, follow at Bill Bartholomew on X.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.
Since the origins of the Washington Bridge saga, really, back in December, there's one thing that we've been talking about for weeks on end, months on end, and that is the idea that suddenly out of nowhere, a random catastrophic event occurred at the beginning of December that caused a sudden, unexpected closure of the Washington Bridge. It's something that engineers, inspectors, journalists, and others have been on this program talking about. I've certainly been telling you about it. But there's always been a little bit of a gap in terms of a timeline, in terms of facts around how far back this thing goes. Patrick Anderson of the Providence Journal really laid this out in the best detail that anybody has yet in a report that was released on April 17th. Headlined, "A report warned the state about the Washington Bridge in 2015. Why was nothing done?" Patrick joins us this morning. Thanks for your time.
Hey, Bill. Great to be here.
What is the AECOM report in 2014, 2015 that was an evaluation of the bridge itself?
Well, it was one of a series of reports that the DOT had their expert consultants do, inspecting the bridge, looking at it, doing some modeling, and seeing what kind of condition it is in. And they do that for all of the bridges, and particularly the ones that are older and in bad shape. And they're trying to figure out what the bridge needs in terms of repairs and whether it should be given a weight limit so really heavy trucks don't go on it. And this particular one came after a series of reports, at least going back to 2009, it might even go back further, were warning that this bridge was in bad shape. They did one in 2012 that said it was in bad shape. And then this one where they did the studying in 2014 and then it was published in 2015 was probably the low point of the ones that I saw where they really were concerned and laid out a whole list of repairs that should be done to prevent having to put a weight limit on the bridge for heavy trucks.
There's a lot of in-depth sort of specialization required to fully break down these reports. I'm sure that you've consulted with experts to be able to lay this out, and or you've taken a crash course in reading and understanding bridge inspection reports. But the bottom line is that when you're talking about the cyclical load-bearing capability of a bridge like the two spans of the Washington Bridge, the east and westbound, it's a matter of time. It's a matter of volume of weight over a period of time that really comes into play. So you can make an argument that over the course of the last decade or so, that cyclical weight-bearing issue has been further exacerbated. So it leaves open a question that may be answered by the forthcoming forensic analysis, but you pose it in your article. If the state had listened to this AECOM report in 2014 and had started work immediately to at minimum shore up the bridge, whether in the post-tensioning system or in the superstructure itself, whatever, could we have gotten to a point where we never had the type of inconvenience and now expense that we're facing today? That's a big question, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it leads into kind of the second really sticky and unanswered part of this, which is why the repairs that were ordered never actually got done. And it's possible that even if they had started right after that 2015 report and actually gotten into the bridge beams and started doing major repairs, they would have found all of these problems earlier and realized, oh, we can't repair this. It's already too far gone, and we're going to have to knock it down and build a new one anyway. Or they may have gotten in there and said, well, it's getting bad, but we can fix this. If we shore up these beams, wrap them in this kind of fiberglass stuff, they'll be okay. Yeah, hopefully the McKee administration's forensic analysis will answer that. We can't tell now with what we've got. But either way, the fact that these repairs never got done until now, and even now they've never been done. The contractor working on it was just getting to this critical area, and that's part of why the situation came to a head in December, is they were really starting to get to that point where they couldn't put off that part of the work anymore.
Essentially a point of no return. You know, we've heard time and time again from, whether it's Al Vitti, the director of the Department of Transportation, for anyone who doesn't know that by now, whoever around this project from officialdom, that there really was no warning, that, boy, isn't it great that the young engineer discovered this in December, and if it hadn't been for that young engineer randomly discovering a problem with a cantilever, we would never have even known that this bridge was in jeopardy. This finding that you uncovered in the AECOM report from 2014-2015, and really everything surrounding it, contradicts that narrative.
Yeah. And I don't know whether some of that gloss that they've been kind of putting on the condition of the bridge when it was shut down is because some people at the top were unaware, or it is part of a strategy to help maximize the amount of money that the state can get, or the amount of money it won't lose through this whole mess. I mean, they're relying on the federal government to pick up the majority of the tab. But in some circumstances, if the state has messed up maintenance or neglected maintenance or made errors, then they can't get that 80% from the federal government. And so I think they're a little bit walking a tightrope there. And at the same time, then they're hoping to go to court and sue some of these contractors who are involved in it. And if the state made errors, that's going to be part of the defense of the contractors. And they still have an outstanding or a just terminated contract with the company that was doing the work when it all shut down, Barletta Aetna. That was $78 million. And I don't know how that's going to be resolved. You can't just cancel a contract and say, oh, we're stopping now. It's not quite that simple. I mean, that was part of what happened with the previous contract with Cardi. They canceled it in the middle, and they basically paid out almost the entire thing. So it's not clear how much of McKee said in his statements that he wants to get half of that $78 million back, or more than half. I don't know if that's what they'll get or not.
Yeah, it remains to be seen. And you referenced the Wistow Savage investigation, if you will. And you asked a really good question. I'm pretty sure it was you anyway, at one of the recent press briefings. If the McKee assigned and retained attorneys are looking into contractors, be it Cardi, Barletta, anybody else that may be involved on a subcontract level, we don't know exactly who and how far out the scope of those working on the project will actually be. But one thing that is very interesting is that you can deflect responsibility away from state officials in this, first of all, by the pay structure that Savage and Wistow will receive at 16 2/3 of everything that's ultimately recovered. In other words, in simplest of terms, those attorneys, they may not be looking at, or may not have even, it may not be within their assigned purview to take a look at failures that may have occurred within the state, particularly the DOT.
Yeah, and some engineer at Rideout or some project manager is probably not going to have $20, $50 million in their bank account that you can get anyway. I mean, a lot of these, right. you know, you go where the money is if you're in the litigation business, at least as I understand it. So that seems like the most lucrative or fruitful angle to take. But if that is in fact what they do, that will probably leave some holes in what the public finds out about what happened on the state side overlooking these things. I mean, even if these companies screwed up, and it looks like at least to some extent, at least one and possibly more of them did, it's still the state's job as the owner of the bridge to oversee what is happening. And I don't know if just completely washing your hands and saying it was all on them, you know, we have no role in this is going to wash.
Yeah, it's certainly a terrible look. And if nothing else, it's a terrible look on a political level. You mentioned and actually go into great detail about the political jockeying around bridge repair. And of course, we just saw on Sunday night, Gina Raimondo, our former governor, profiled swimmingly on 60 Minutes. And look, a lot of the local issues that people scream about when they complain about Gina Raimondo, whether it's cooler and warmer or truck tolls or things like that, or more sticky issues like pension reform, and frankly, the bridge, they may or may not have any impact, probably won't have any impact on her political future. Nonetheless, when you look at the Washington Bridge, it's impossible to ignore that this project and really the troubles thereof went directly through the Raimondo administration. And of course, many of us remember the Gina jam, which was right before the 2018 election when suddenly work was halted on the bridge because it was going to make for an unpleasant drive for a lot of her potential voters.
Yeah. I mean, no politician wants to do road work on their watch, because you do it, you create traffic jams to fix the roads and fix the bridges. But if you don't do it, you end up in a situation where you have to close everything down. I've not found the email or the communication that really gets at what happened in 2018, of how much of that calculus of first changing the pattern of traffic of what ramps they were going to close and not close was done for political reasons, if any, and then the decision to kind of scrap the work partway through and reopen the bridge right before the election, how much of that was political. I would love to find that out and get a really candid assessment of if any of the campaign operatives and folks were working their magic back in 2018 for either of those things.
Right. And it's interesting when you hear people say Bridgegate. I was in New York for the actual Bridgegate Chris Christie, and there was hard evidence that showed, yeah, staffers said, let's create a traffic jam for political reasons. And that's a lot different than what we've seen so far anyway, and what's come to light with the Washington Bridge fiasco, even going back through or into Chafee era.
Yeah.
There's a behind the scenes deal going on, Carty versus Barletta. The Carty thing is weird. Carty Corporation is a household name for most people in Southern New England, and suddenly shut down mere days after the Washington Bridge westbound span was shut down. Give us in sum what you found that's happening between Carty and Barletta, these two construction companies in simplest of terms.
Well, these construction companies, they have the pretty fierce rivalries, and they're not always the best of friends and on the friendliest of terms. But I mean, part of that is it's a little bit, or it can be a little bit of a zero-sum game winning these state contracts. I mean, these are the companies that do the actual work, but someone's going to get the contracts and someone isn't. And essentially, Carty was one of the big fish here who was getting road work and bridge work, and that kind of dried up over the last decade. And the last couple of big bridge projects, or some of the last couple of big bridge projects that Barletta got, including the Washington Bridge, feel like they were the nail in the coffin for Cardi, that they needed some of this work and needed some of these projects to keep going. And it didn't happen. Barletta got the big 610 interchange reconstruction, which is much bigger than the Washington Bridge project. They got the Henderson Bridge, and it really dried up for Cardi. And that looks like it led to their demise. Exactly what happened before all of this in 2017, 2018, with when they were on the Washington Bridge and did not finish the contract, that is really fuzzy, and it's tough to figure out. One possibility is they were there and they got a sense that the bridge was in much worse shape than they thought, and just didn't want to even attempt to do it at the prices the state was going to pay. But it's really murky what happened there.
And of course, lastly, what happens next? What are we looking for? Obviously, the forensic report, and just today we're taping this on a Monday. Reports from an anecdotal level are that traffic is running a lot smoother with now both the east and westbound spans restriped to have three lanes, this being the westbound bypass on the eastbound bridge. You've got a situation where apparently it's about as wide as the Newport Bridge, for example, the lane. So we know from anecdotal reports this morning that it seems to be a little better. That's good for the public. But in terms of the big picture, what are we looking for?
Yeah, well, people are going to have to get used to the situation like it is now. I think we're probably at a point now with these three narrower lanes opened in each direction. That's probably going to be the status quo for a couple of years. And yeah, it does seem better as long as there aren't accidents than what we had for the last couple of months. People are just going to have to get used to that to some point. I don't think they can really do much more than they've done here. The next stages are going to be we're waiting for the lawsuit and the forensic report that's going to point the lawsuit in the direction that it's going to take. Also waiting on kind of the money side of this and to see what the bill is that's going to be to the state in the short term and the long term. I don't know if there's going to need to be any money spent in the budget this year, but they're going to have to get a handle on kind of what the price tag for rebuilding this thing is going to be over the long term and what bite that takes out of other things the state wants to spend money on. And then just hopefully we'll get a better picture of, you know, who really messed up and how big a screw up it was versus just it was an old bridge that wasn't an amazing design and they didn't maintain it that well. And it's kind of the blame is shared around to a little bit to a whole lot of folks. Those are some of the questions we're still looking for answers on.
Patrick Anderson, The Providence Journal. Subscribe to The Providence Journal. Follow Patrick on X. And amazing work. It's been enjoyable to watch you working these press conferences as well, and really, really looking at this from a 36,000 foot view. And I think that initially there was a lot of conversation about, wow, this is going to suck for people who live in Barrington, and what are we going to do to get them home tonight? And the reality is this is a major story. This is a major likely failure of government, and great work.
Thanks. Appreciate it, Bill. Always fun.
Bartholomew Town is presented in part by the University of Rhode Island Online, who offer a wide array of programs. Visit uri.edu/online or give them a call at 401-874-5280. That's uri.edu/online or call 401-874-5280.